From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A surprise shakeup in the Israeli government as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Tuesday he was firing his cabinet and calling for new elections. The move comes after days of intense political infighting between Netanyahu and his coalition partners. Intensified unrest in Mexico Monday as protesters raised their demands to a new level, the resignation of the country's president, Enrique Peña Nieto. We have this report from Telesur.
Thousands of protesters across the country took to the streets in Mexico, marking President Enrique Peña Nieto's second year in office, demanding his resignation. Demonstrations became violent at times as frustrated and angry protesters set cars on fire and broke windows of government buildings. Since 43 students disappeared from Guerrero State, President Peña Nieto has become increasingly unpopular. Protesters have criticized the government's lack of response, slow investigative process, and accused local, state, and national officials of corruption. And now to our correspondent in Mexico, Clayton Kahn, with more on the Ayotzinapa-related protests.
Marking the first day of his third year in office, Mexico's President Enrique Peña Nieto celebrated in Mexico's southern Chiapas state his sweeping yet polemic structural reforms.
Establish a new platform, a new legal groundwork that opens the country to greater prosperity, development, and better conditions for all Mexicans.
However, in streets throughout the country, people marched, expressing a deep distrust of the president and the country's system of justice, continuing the demand for the return alive of 43 students who were forcibly disappeared in September.
We are calling for the resignation of the Attorney General and of Peña Nieto because now, with 2 months and a week, they have not said anything on the whereabouts of those youth. They say pure lies to the parents and families.
Yet while the signs express the demand for the resignation of the president, some doubt the viability and reach that change would have at solving Mexico's deep insecurity crisis.
The denouncements of Peña are not going to solve our problems because our problems are that there is no justice nor rule of law.
The march in the Mexican capital ended late at the iconic Angel of Independence monument. With the fall or not of the president, what these demonstrators appear to truly demand is fundamental systemic changes. Clayton Kahn, Telesur, Mexico City.
A new poll by the newspaper Reforma shows that President Peña Nieto may be in trouble, with the number of Mexicans who disapprove of his administration now at 59%, with only 39% approving. A similar poll last April had those numbers at 49% approval and 49% disapproval. Meanwhile, the search for the bodies of the 43 missing student teachers turned up the bodies of more victims this past Sunday, further stoking the demands for Peña Nieto's resignation. Press TV's Alistair Bavistock reports from Mexico.
Five decapitated and burned bodies were found on Sunday in the state of Guerrero, where 43 students went missing at the hands of a criminal cartel earlier this year. The bodies were found outside the town of Chilapa, where the federal forces have yet to take control following a scandal that has rocked Mexico's government to its core. During their search for the missing students, both federal forces and volunteers from around the country have discovered numerous murder sites, revealing a history of brutality that goes far back past the recent tragedy. The decapitation and burning of the bodies mimics the manner in which Mexico's government claims the 43 students were murdered.
The graves we have found go back far further in time than anyone had previously thought. Given the impunity these criminals have received, the longer the students are missing, the less likely it is that they remain alive.
Many Mexicans are calling for the deposition of the country's current government, which it blames for not tackling the institutional corruption.
Nothing of what the government has said or done throughout the scandal has convinced me that it's working for the people's best interests. What we need is concrete action, not endless talk and debate, which lead to nothing.
As the evidence of terrible brutality at the hands of organized crime continues to appear in Guerrero State, Mexico's government is facing serious pressure. The public is demanding a fresh start, an end to the corruption which stopped the authorities from fulfilling their primary role. that of guaranteeing public safety. Alistair Bavistock, Press TV, Mexico City.
Following an attempt Monday by a delegation of British lawmakers to conduct an on-site investigation of protests in Hong Kong, China's foreign ministry restated the country's refusal to admit them, characterizing their visit as an attempted provocation and interference in its internal affairs. Ministry spokesperson Hua Chunying said Beijing supports Hong Kong's local government officials and warned the UK and others not to interfere in Hong Kong's affairs.
The central government of China has made it clear to fully support the government of the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region to deal with its affairs in accordance with law. China also firmly opposes the interference of any foreign government, organization, or individual in Hong Kong affairs. It will be useless for those from the British side who attempt to continue to provoke over the issue. China is willing to develop friendly and cooperative relations with other countries, including the UK, but on the basis of mutual respect, equality, and mutual benefit, and non-interference in each other's internal affairs. China hopes the UK could join efforts with us in promoting healthy bilateral relations between the two countries. Only in this way could the people on both sides benefit.
Meanwhile, one of the organizers of the protests has gone on a hunger strike. The protesters demand that Beijing stay out of the organizing process for Hong Kong's next election. RT's Matt Trezza spoke with Victor Zhigai-Gao, the director of the China National Association of International Studies, for more.
I listened to the spokesman of the foreign ministry in Beijing very carefully, and I think she has a point. Hong Kong is part of China, and China has a sovereign right to block anyone from entering into Hong Kong if China believes that the entry or the presence of that person or that group person will disturb social order in Hong Kong. And I would say for British politicians in particular, when they left Hong Kong in 1997, there was not a lot of democracy to start with. If they were very, very serious about democracy, they should have brought more democracy to Hong Kong in the 150 years when they ruled Hong Kong as a colony. So I see there is a lot of hypocrisy in what some of the British parliamentarians are doing right now. And I think their goals will not be achieved because China has the legitimate sovereign right to block their entry into Hong Kong.
U.S. lawmakers recently presenting a bill in the Congress saying democracy in Hong Kong is under threat from Beijing. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
I think it's a very exaggerated claim. To be very honest, in 1997, when the British left Hong Kong, there was minimum, if any, democracy at all in Hong Kong. All the governors in Hong Kong for more than 150 years were appointed by the monarch in London rather than being elected. There was no election at all for the legislatures in Hong Kong. Therefore, between 1997 and 2014, if anyone has any decency and any objectivity to look at the situation in Hong Kong, measuring the progress of democracy in Hong Kong, he or she should come up with the real and valid conclusion that democracy is improving in Hong Kong rather than being deteriorating. And also, I think, if you look at the core issue which is being argued about back and forth in Hong Kong, it's not about universal suffrage. Everyone wants to have universal suffrage. It is about the nominating process. And tell me whether there is any country which does not have a nominating process for the head of the government in any political system.
But in this case, the nominating process, they want it to come from the people to choose the nominees instead of the nominees being approved by Beijing. Isn't that their main grievance?
No, actually, I think your point is a little bit inaccurate. Right now, what is being proposed is to have a nominating committee composed of 1,200 members from all walks of life in Hong Kong. And there will be no person in mainland China or from Beijing participating in the nominating process. Now, if you think a committee composed of 1,200 people are not representative of Hong Kong, make a point. You know, whether it should be reduced or enlarged, whether it should be 2,000, you know, in 10 years' time from now, all these are legitimate points, and these can be discussed and consulted upon in the political process. But to claim that you have a nominating committee of 1,200 local people in Hong Kong is an erosion of democracy, that's really far-fetched. And also, for 150 years of British rule in Hong Kong, there was no election, there was no participation by the broad masses of the people, and now we are talking about introducing universal suffrage in Hong Kong in 2017. Anyone who claims that's retrogression rather than progression is out of his or her mind.
President Barack Obama issued a statement referring to continuing concerns about human rights in China. RT's Guyan Shichikayan looks at the example the U.S. is setting as it deals with domestic unrest.
The U.S. loves protests when they happen overseas, especially when they're against governments Washington is not friendly with. When protests flared up in Hong Kong, Washington called on the authorities there to show restraint. Does the U.S. always live up to its own standards? Restraint is not what people saw on the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, where thousands took to the streets to protest what they saw as a deep bias within the police force against black people. Tear gas, rubber bullets, flash grenades, and armored vehicles were deployed against largely peaceful protesters.
Police and the security people, you know, broke the links and put handcuffs on us.
3 years ago, police cracked down on Occupy Wall Street protesters. In just one day, in October, 700 people were arrested in New York trying to march across the Brooklyn Bridge.
Certain protests and demonstrations in the United States are allowed to go on because no one's listening to them. It's four or five people standing around with a sign. Who cares, you know? And then they can say, look how democratic we are. We let these five people stand around with a sign. But when you have protests that actually pick up momentum and actually have the potential to change things, that's when the hammer starts to come down.
In the handling of mass protests like Occupy Wall Street and Ferguson, authorities here, by many accounts, have failed to live up to the same standards of restraint that U.S. leaders preach overseas. In Washington, I'm Ganesh Chakyan, RT.
Here in the U.S., protests continued Monday across the nation over the grand jury's decision last week to not indict white Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson for shooting and killing unarmed black teen Mike Brown in August. Thousands of students in New York City joined thousands who marched from Union Square to Times Square in Manhattan. Press TV's Caleb Maupin was there and gave this report.
A crowd of several thousand high school students assembled in New York City's Union Square after walking out of school. They expressed anger about issues they say directly affect them, thousands of miles from Ferguson, Missouri.
Well, I know myself and a lot of other people who are afraid to walk to the store. When I was in Westchester in the past, I was afraid to go to the store. I was afraid to go to my house. I was afraid to go to my friend's house because I was afraid the police officer would kill me or harass me.
Some of the students expressed frustration with the repeated calls for calm from President Barack Obama.
How can he expect for us not to protest when this can be one of us? This can be, you know, one of our friends, one of our cousins, our own parents. It's harmful. It's just bad.
After walking out of school, the students marched throughout Lower Manhattan, demanding justice for Michael Brown and chanting against racism. They concluded their rally at Times Square. Along the march route, several young people were arrested. The students expressed anger at the reaction they received from the NYPD.
If we're peacefully protesting, they're like raging at us with different type of weapons, and I don't think that it's right.
High school teacher Rachel Chapman joined her students in walking out to protest.
This is the beginning of a movement that has started amongst young people here.
As the students concluded their rally in Times Square, a long-range acoustic device used to attack protesters with ear-piercing sounds was unveiled by the police, who continued to order the students to disperse. The New York City walkouts took place as part of a national call, with thousands of students walking out of school and protesting all across the country. Caleb Maupin, Press TV, New York.
In Atlanta, student protesters interrupted Attorney General Eric Holder's speech on race relations at Ebenezer Baptist Church Monday.
They are not consistent with the wishes of Michael Brown's father, who asked that his son be remembered peacefully. Now, I have great respect for that man. I cannot begin to understand.
According to one veteran activist, Black Americans have reemerged as real actors on the national scene in ways they have not been perceived for decades. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford spoke with Omali Yeshitila, the chair of the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations, who sees a new militancy being exhibited that says black really is back.
I think that's right. And I think that what it shows us is that the notion that this government and all of its media entities have been trying to promote the insignificance of the African population politically is gone with the wind, when it's real clear that even as a consequence of the process that emerged in Ferguson that for weeks and months led to ongoing kinds of demonstration, mobilization in the streets, and the creation of a battle-seasoned group of young working-class people who've been in a contest with the police now for months, you know, day in and day out, that African people in this country occupy just a critical strategic problem for this government, and the one that led to the government in the 1960s declaring that the Black Panther Party was the most serious internal threat to the security of the United States since the Civil War. And what we're seeing now is that subsequent to the development of motion, collective consciousness stemming from the resistance responding to the assassination of Mike Brown, I think this government has an incredible quandary that it has had to deal with the reemergence of black people in this post-racial situation that's supposed to be defined by the presidency of Barack Hussein Obama.
Yes, and it seems to go beyond the government and beyond just ruling circles. This long period of quietude that we've seen in black America has led to things such as, well, pollsters often don't even break out what black opinion is when they do their polls, as used to be routine, as if, well, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I just think that what we've seen and continue to see at this moment is a need for the system to be able to show some other kind of reality. The whole country is experiencing an anxiety that's made really clear by what is happening in the St. Louis, Ferguson, Missouri area with the increasing arms sales that's going on. Nobody's talking about that, Glenn. Even as they might report, you'll see one thing in the newspaper on the internet about the escalating sales of weapons. There's no commentary going on about that. There's no editorials being written about the fact that white people are arming themselves to the teeth in Ferguson, in St. Louis, in that whole Missouri area. It's a crisis of, I think, great magnitude, and they haven't the slightest idea exactly how to deal with it, but they know they have a problem.
And now the United States has a huge image problem looming, such as they have not had to confront in terms of internal dissent and volatility in decades.
And that's true. And the thing about the image problem, I think, is given greater significance today, even than in the 1960s. You know, when there was a Soviet Union and the U.S. was engaged in a certain kind of ideological war about which system was best, and the glaring oppression status of African people was clearly a negative as far as they are concerned. I think today the problem is, and I think it's a real contradiction that I don't hear being discussed at all, is that the tenacity, the sustained level of struggle that's been happening in Ferguson that does not even get reported on effectively. You know that at one juncture, the Federal Aviation Authority had even prohibited aircraft from flying over Ferguson because they did not want news helicopters to be able to capture images of resistance there. They have a problem that this thing has sustained so long, and that everybody in the United States who is interested in any kind of struggle has gone into Ferguson. I think the U.S. government is clearly concerned about the possibility of a real insurgency emerging in this country, similar in some ways to what they saw in the 1960s when they could identify particular organizations that allowed them to declare that the Black Panther Party was the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States at that time since the Civil War. Now what they have are these, in many instances, unnamed forces, just groups of African people who have achieved certain kind of consciousness and an inability to predict whether or not this sustained resistance will grow in other places and will also increase in intensity, whether or not it could actually lead in certain places to individuals or groups of people deepening this crisis by striking out in other forms of struggle that would prove to be highly problematic for the United States. It is a serious problem because they can't even crush Ferguson because of the political, it's not simply a military issue, it's a political issue. So when we talk about the image of the United States today, what we're talking about is an image that still provides a situation where the Russian parliament debates whether or not a peacekeeping team should be sent into the United States to protect the interests of and security of black people. They're debating it in places like Iran, where the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine has sent solidarity message, where the Alliance of Latin American and Caribbean States have made statements in support of us. If you're talking about an insurgency emerging, what it also means is that places like Ukraine, where the U.S. actually engineered the overthrow of a government in other places, the U.S. has to contend with Russia with its own agenda and a certain capacity, and Iran and all these other places. An insurgency is something that can be recognized by the international community, and support can be offered to it. So this whole question of image, I think, has a real practical implications in terms of deepening what may become, what could become a very severe contradiction. All the countries around the world, whether it's China, Russia, Iran, any other forces under attack right now, could have, see as a strategic interest, lending support of whatever kind of support to a genuine insurgency emerging in this country to undermine the ability of the U.S. to do these horrible things that it's doing around the world. So this is an extraordinary element of vulnerability that the United States government is confronted with at this time, the ruling class is confronted with at this time, the state. So you see reports that the FBI is working with police organizations throughout the United States to prepare them for the possibility that extremist groups all around this country, some of them armed, are going to strike out. They have a predicament, and it's really something to watch them try to wiggle out of it. And believe me, well, I don't have to tell you that not only is Holder, but Obama himself, both of them are presiding over the response that's coming to try to contain this situation. It's a big problem that they have, because the thing is that this resistance reverberates throughout this country, and this relationship that black people have with the police is a critical, fundamental kind of contradiction, because the police function as the first line of defense for colonialism inside this country.
And of course, the militarization of the U.S. police was central to a counterinsurgency strategy directed against black people set in motion more than four decades ago.
That is absolutely true. I mean, you can even trace the emergence of forces like SWAT teams to the contest that in Los Angeles between the Los Angeles Police Department and the Black Panther Party. And when we talk about the Los Angeles Police Department, we're talking about an organization that's notorious for exporting terrorist training to police organizations and military forces throughout the world. So that's SWAT going back to the 1970s. And part of what that is, too, is that at the moment where the black movement publicly swore off philosophical nonviolence, that is to say, where the leadership of a certain sector of the middle class that promoted philosophical nonviolence, at the moment that became clear, and you could see that with the advent of the March Against Fear following the shooting of Meredith in Mississippi, and this debate that went down between King and Carmichael that was symbolic of this, then white people as individuals could no longer be relied on as the sole extensions of the state to control black people. So special organizations began to merge even back at that time, where you don't have police coming one in a car or two in a car, but just to arrest people in domestic issues. Now you have a whole squadron of forces, and throughout this country, we see special weapons teams, and now the military has a special section of its budget, the U.S. Pentagon, that's for supplying police organizations in these communities throughout the country with military hardware. They call it surplus, but it's crazy. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to characterize something as surplus when you're doing it year after year after year. That's not surplus. That's a part of the military budget that's disguised because of all kinds of political and even legal prohibitions of military occupation of communities inside this country.
Yes, there are 80,000 SWAT raids every year.
Yeah. And the thing is, what happens to us has become so ubiquitous that it's almost normal. We just live with it, and we have reached a place where the community, with the help of some people like Sharpton and others, and Obama himself, we blame ourselves for it. They must have done something wrong. When you see an officer, you're supposed to not speak loudly. You're supposed to make your keep your hands as though that's normal, where everybody can see you, etc. And that's been treated as a norm in our community, where throughout this country, there are hundreds of thousands of young black men who don't even have driver's license anymore because they've been snatched up for all kinds of phony reasons, from non-payment of child support in an economy that won't allow young black men to work, which means that they're constantly violating the law because they're constantly having to drive, which means they're constantly having confrontation with the police. They're on bicycles. They stopped on bicycles. They stopped in every manner that is possible to be harassed. The U.S. government and the military, so I'm talking about the occupation forces like the police, cannot act differently from what they do. So no matter what you say about cameras, there was a camera that took the picture of the police that killed Eric Garner. The fact is that we've had situations where I am right now where police stopped a 17-year-old, shot at him 17 times in his vehicle, killed him, and the two cars with cameras, unfortunately, had cameras that were not operable. They were not working. And it doesn't matter. Or you got a situation like in Los Angeles when this brother is beaten nearly to death, Rodney King, and you've got the cameras as evidence, and then it still does no good. So the question is not that. The police cannot function and cannot act any differently than what they are acting, because their mission is to control this colonized population. In fact, the police, as an entity of the state apparatus in this country, was created specifically to deal with black people, Indians, and so-called Mexicans whose land had been stolen. And that's where the essence of the state apparatus in this country achieved its identity.
Yes, the Texas Rangers credit themselves before the turn of the 20th century with having killed 5,000 Mexicans and Mexican-Americans.
And I think it's really interesting to note that the Texas Rangers started out as an organization similar to this group that's in Ferguson that's arming themselves to the teeth. These were private guys. These were private citizens. These were individual white people who did this and went out on missions killing Indians and taking Mexican land. And it was only later that they were actually made a formal component of the U.S. state.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.